This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
If you've been following along with the Corey Richens case, you're probably well aware that Corey Richens has left a trail of utter destruction in virtually every relationship that she's touched over the last God knows how long, at least the relationships that have come to light in this trial. We're going to go through all of those so you get a real full picture of this woman and get, I guess, even greater context to who the person that is accused of murdering her husband actually is. Does she have the propensity to carry out what she's been accused of? I think when you have it all in front of you and we kind of wrangle it all together, everything you need to know about this woman in terms of her interpersonal relationships, how she handles people, how she handles things, how she handles anything in her life, especially when it comes to being an advantage to her and not to others, how she hits the gas on, well, this is going to benefit me, I'm going to go down that road pretty damn strong. That's what we're going to be exploring today in this piece. I want to get your thoughts in the comment section as we work our way through it. Substack and YouTube are the places to do that. Hit subscribe wherever you're listening right now. So let's go back. It was Valentine's Day. I know we're talking about this again, but this is part of the context. We're not going to rehash every aspect of this case. We're going to go to these specific people, specific incidences, and specific events that really matter, that really show us a clearer picture of who Corey Richens is, if you didn't already have one. So Valentine's Day 2014, let's start there. Or Valentine's Day 2022, February 14th is what I'm talking about. And somewhere in Utah, Cody Wright picked up a phone call from his business partner, Eric Richens. He took the call the way you take any call from someone you've known for years, without thinking much about it. But something was wrong. According to Wright's testimony, the voice on the other end wasn't the Eric Richens he knew. There was fear and an urgency, a tone Wright said he had only heard from Eric twice before in his life. Once when Eric's mother died and once when he'd been in a serious accident. That was it. You know that tone you get with friends. You're like, hey, what's going on? You're like, hey. You're like, oh, God, something is going on here. Because, of course, I like to answer the phone when my friends call me and go, hey, what's going on? So I'm like, hey, are you okay? Yeah, everything's great. I just had a value meal at the restaurant. Oh, my God, are you okay? It was delicious. You just talk like that just to freak people out. And then you move on. It's a great day. I'm kidding. But you know what I mean? The feel. The mood, it's that almost inability after you've gone through some sort of a trauma and you're trying to communicate to talk in any other way because you're just trying to get the message out because you are so traumatized by what has just occurred. And in this moment in time, Eric is contemplating and really, I think, realizing that his wife very realistically just attempted to murder him. That's kind of serious. He was calling because he was scared. And according to prosecutors, the reason he was scared was his wife. That sandwich and getting sick. 3 weeks later, Eric Richens was dead. That phone call is where this story actually begins. Not with the charges, not with the arrest, not with the children's book that came later. It begins with a man who couldn't call his own wife on Valentine's Day because prosecutors allege she was the threat. It begins with a man who had to use his business partner as a lifeline, his brother-in-law as a secret conduit to a divorce attorney, and his own home email as a communications risk, a man who was trapped inside his own life and who, according to the evidence presented at trial, was surrounded on every side by a person who put him there. Corey Richens, of course, has pled not guilty to charges of aggravated murder, attempted murder, insurance fraud, and forgery. She is presumed innocent until proven otherwise, but the picture prosecutors have built over the more than 2 weeks of testimony isn't just a picture of a crime, it's the picture of a pattern, and the pattern is this. According to the evidence presented at this trial, nearly every person in Corey Richens' life served a function. When the function was useful, they stayed closed. When it expired or became an obstacle, they got drained, discarded, or used for something else. That's not editorializing this. That's the accounting, witness by witness, dollar by dollar. And it's been presented under oath. Start with Eric, because according to the prosecution, you have to start with Eric to understand everything else. Prosecutors allege Corey used Eric's power of attorney to take out a $250,000 home equity line of credit on their family home, without his knowledge, to fund her real estate business. Their home was on the line. When Eric found out, his brother-in-law, Clinton Benson, testified that Eric was very upset and sad. The conversation that followed was about divorce attorneys. Eric believed Corey was monitoring his emails, so he couldn't even contact a lawyer directly. He had to route his own legal communications through his brother-in-law, like a man running an underground operation inside his own marriage. At some point before his death, prosecutors allege Corey applied for $2 million in life insurance on Eric's life. A forensic handwriting expert testified at trial that the signature on the application probably wasn't Eric's, that it appeared to be a simulated forgery written by someone who had access to his handwriting and was attempting to replace it. According to prosecutors, Eric Richens was insured for his own death without his knowledge by the person who allegedly caused it. He was consulting a lawyer to get out. He never got out. And there's Chelsea Barney, described at trial as Corey's lifelong best friend, the kind of friend you call first, trust completely, the kind of friend most people spend their entire lives trying to find. And according to testimony, Chelsea Barney lost her entire life savings in a real estate deal with Corey that went wrong. Everything gone. And she still showed up. She still took the calls. She was still apparently the person Corey leaned on after Eric died. Text messages shown in court included Corey writing to Chelsea in the aftermath of her husband's death. "They will not take from me what is mine." This is an observation, and I'm curious, in the comment section, to anyone who has ever dealt with someone like a Corey. And again, we're not diagnosing her, but many times in our discussions here, I've described her in the way I can relate to her personality. She strikes me, and again, this is just in my opinion, not diagnosing, I have no idea, very borderline, very narcissistic personality disorder, very cluster B to the nth degree. That's my opinion. I do not know. But if we're looking at the pattern, that's what the pattern tells me, someone who's been through this a time or two. We won't go into all the details. I got a question for anybody else out there who's dealt with someone like this. When they're grandstanding like this, after they've exited some sort of situation, or the situation is exited from them, And they're being forced to reckon with the consequences of their actions. And in some cases, it's taking something away. If you're getting a divorce, sometimes it's, well, guess what? You no longer have access to your husband's money because it's not yours, because he earned it. You didn't. And because you've been sitting there stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars for the last however long, it can be situations where you're being taken from in other ways, and the person is held accountable. Oh, you didn't work all those hours, and now you expect full pay. Those sort of things. They get very, very vitriolic, and they start speaking. In my opinion, I'm curious if you've seen this. In this almost HBO kind of period, almost, I don't even know what the era, Victorian-ish,
they will not take from me what is mine. I mean, it's like,
it wouldn't really be used in a sentence in any other way, except when you're really trying to grandstand. Have you noticed this? Have you noticed this in these types of people? When they're put into the corner, they start speaking like they're out of some sort of Elizabethan novel. I mean, it does. It's like, oh, if you put it that way, I'm going to take you so much more seriously because it sounds like it's a snippet, you know, from this very old, aged book that has all of the wisdom of the decades and the centuries of people that came before you. And of course, your own words too, Corey. They will not take from me what is mine. It's interesting. I've noticed this as a pattern in this type of behavior. Where regular vernacular goes out the window and it gets very, oh, Elizabethan almost. And maybe I'm described, maybe the terms I'm using are not quite accurate, but you know, you get it. You get what I'm talking about. Have you noticed this? Have you noticed this in these types of people? When they get into the corner, when the mask is pulled down a bit, suddenly they start speaking in these terms. I'm curious. Again, there's so many things with these folks. Like, they all go to the same damn convention. How to destroy your life and others around you. When you get caught, start speaking like this. And separately, according to testimony, Corey and Chelsea, or Corey rather, sent Chelsea a message assuring her that investigators had found nothing on either of them. Them. Oh, yeah, of course, they always try to pull other people into their fold of chaos because it's not just them. The woman who had already lost everything, trusting her, was being used again. Different function, same playbook. Nothing on them. Yeah, because as if she has anything to do with it. You crazy, crazy. There was another friend, unnamed in the headlines, but naughty in the evidence. Forensic accountant, Brooke Carrington, testified about a text exchange in which Corey encouraged a friend to wire her $45,000 as a down payment on a property deal. The friend sent the money. The deal never closed. According to Carrington, as soon as that $45,000 landed in Corey's account, it was gone. Spent immediately on an outstanding debt payment. No deal, no refund, no record of a conversation about what happened to it. So you're a lifelong friend. I believe she was a waitress. This is her life savings. Yeah, Corey, this sounds great. I'm going to invest in this. Let me cover my debts with your money. The modality to do that is really, it's stunning. It shows such a lack of empathy for humanity, anyone else in your life. I mean, just for a second, think to yourself about this scenario here. Let's say you lend a friend some money. Let's say you lend a friend $100, $200. Let's say you take, let's do this. Let's do it the other way around. Let's do it from the Corey perspective. Let's say your friend, you're in really a tough situation and your friend lends you $100. Okay. $100. It's a nice little amount of money. I mean, it's nothing to sniff at. It's like if you lend somebody $100, I don't know. I think in most cases you expect to get it paid back unless you're like, I gotcha. You're good. You know? So let's say you take that $100 and you told your friend, okay, I need to get groceries this week. You know, the kids, it's really tough. They're hungry. We got to get food. I'm really, it's a mess right now. I gotcha. I can help. And then they go and spend that money to pay down bills, debts from other previous horrible choices that they made. And not on the food that they said they needed. It really makes you question that human being, what that person is capable of, what that person truly thinks and truly feels. Their actions and their words are not congruent in any way, shape, or form. And it's disturbing that they're going to take that $100. I mean, it's $100. I mean, it's $100. $100 is $100. I don't care how freaking rich you are or not. $100 is $100. It goes a lot less further today than it did 5 years ago, but still, it's $100. And it's a bit of a betrayal if that person doesn't use the money for what they said they were going to do it for, the reason you lent it to them. If they said, I need $100 to pay down my debts over, like, I don't think I, like, that's on you, my friend. I hope you figure that shit out. But I don't have a bunch of debts. I've been more responsible with my money than you. It's not to shove it in your face. It's just I don't have those sorts of debts. So no, I'm not taking my money and funding your debts. It's a little different than I need money for food or something. But anyway, $45,000 is what Corey took in, spent on something completely different. And this was a real estate investment, not buying food that she was supposed to be spending it on for her friends. So everything would go in her friend's name and such. Completely lied to her about it, allegedly. $45,000. Every red cent this person had gave to her friend. And then Corey just sucked it up and went away. That's stunning. I mean, there's a lot of levers you're pulling to get there, to do that. To feel that this is going to be an okay plan. And I don't care any idea here. Oh, well, she thought if she spent it down over here, she'd make it back over. No, that's just foolishness. That's tomfoolery. And it's going to end in fisticuffs. For she shall have what is hers. Remember? I mean, it's stunning. I mean, it's not murder. But it's like up there. It's up there. It shows an ability to really screw someone over in such an extreme way. I mean, when you kill somebody, at least they're dead. They're not going to keep living in poverty that you just put them into. This is actively putting your friend into poverty and saying, oops, not my fault. That's another level. I mean, again, money and life are obviously two very different things. But am I the only one who feels like it's not worse, but it almost takes a worse person to be able to do that? That's how I kind of feel. It's an interesting dynamic. The action isn't worse than murder, but it takes someone that is worse than a murderer to pull that off. It does. There's Josh Grossman, a boyfriend. He testified that their relationship became romantic around 2020, that he worked on houses Corey was flipping, that she let him live in homes she was renovating. How nice of Corey. She bought him 2 trucks. She gave him money when he needed it. He was like her pet, basically. Said he loved her. When prosecutors asked whether she loved him, he hesitated and said she probably did. Though he acknowledged he likely loved her more than she loved him. Less than a month before Eric Richens died, text messages shown to the grand jury included Corey asking Grossman, if I divorced right now and ask you to marry me tomorrow, you would? He was the contingency plan. He had real emotional investment in a woman who prosecutors argue was running a parallel life with a ticking clock on it. He ended up on the witness stand testifying against her. This is what she left him with.
just utter disregard here for another human being. You can tell this bitch totally used him, totally preyed on him. Talk about predatory behavior.
I mean, let's flip the script here for a moment. If Grossman were Corey, if this were a man that was flipping houses and not doing very good at it and basically failing at the business the whole time, and someone noticed, oh, this woman that you brought in that seems to be rather good at working on your projects. She's lovely. What are you paying her?
I'm not. I just let her stay in the houses, and then I get to F her. And then I bought her a car or something. Like, what? Huh? Like, she's working for you. I'm not paying her at all. No. I get to have sex with her. And she thinks it's great. I just keep telling her,
it would be outrageous. People would be looking at this like R. Kelly shit. They would. If this were flipped, people would be looking at this relationship like R. Kelly. So you basically have bamboozled this woman into convincing her that you love her. She's doing free work for you. You're basically doing her at will, at your will, not necessarily hers, but whenever you feel the need to show some love, quote unquote, spread the love around, she's just there for you. And she doesn't seem very wise about any of it. And she's pretty much coercively at your control because you're not paying her. She's living in your homes. As much as the argument in this case has been trying to make for anyone on the defensive, oh, Corey was trapped. She didn't have money. Really? Show me where the fuck that ever happened. Other than her own words, her own victimization statements that she blithers out of her mouth that really don't seem to land in reality. Oh, Eric was controlled. Really? Was he? Because I think we have a far clearer example of someone coercively controlling another human being here. And it ain't Eric at Corey. Again, if these scripts were flipped, she'd be an even worse monster than she already is. Because it's a guy being manipulated by a woman, and, well, guys just like sex whenever they can get it, so he has got nothing to complain about, does he? She's kind of cute. Doesn't matter the modality in which that all happened, the modality in which she pretty much, again, coercively controlled him and brainwashed him into thinking that this is a great idea. Everybody's an adult. Everybody can make their own decisions. You're exactly right. But, again, there's laws out there that protect people from being taken advantage of. Coercive control is a real thing, and it happens in both directions, and this is a good example of it. If it's all true. There's Carmen Lauber, too, the housekeeper. According to her testimony, Lauber purchased illicit opiate pills for Corey multiple times in early 2022, eventually connecting her to a supplier of pills containing fentanyl after Corey asked for something stronger. When Lauber texted Corey about the fentanyl pills, Corey responded, according to testimony, okay, go ahead and get them. Private investigator Todd Gabler, hired by Eric's family, and logged over 936 hours of work on the case, testified that among all the contacts in Corey's life, she communicated with Lauber more than almost anyone except Eric and her mother. her husband, her mother, her drug source. That was her inner circle. According to the evidence, Lauber didn't choose to become a witness in a murder trial. According to prosecutors, Corey made that decision for her. Eric's family, his sister Katie Richens Benson, his father Eugene, his brother-in-law Clint sat in that courtroom through every day of testimony. They filed a wrongful death lawsuit. They hired Garber, who spent 936 hours and more than $100,000 just to get someone to take seriously what they had believed from the very night they walked through that door. That's the cost of fighting someone when the system isn't ready to move yet. $100,000, nearly 1,000 hours. And while they were doing that, while Katie was spending her own resources and her grief fighting for her brother, Corey was allegedly sitting in a jail cell writing a 6-page letter to her mother. The letter had 3 words written at the top in large letters: walk the dog. And we're going to break that thing down in another piece tomorrow. So press subscribe because you don't want to miss that. According to prosecutors, it was an instruction manual. It allegedly directed Corey's mother to coach her brother into constructing a false narrative, claiming Eric had obtained fentanyl from co-workers in Mexico, building a fictional drug pipeline to counter the forensic evidence. And tucked inside that letter, according to prosecutors, was a directive to find photos of Katie's daughters and send them anonymously to media outlets, specifically to make Katie, the woman who had just lost her brother and was fighting for justice for him, livid. Yeah, let's expose your niece, your nieces. What? She wasn't content with what she allegedly did to the people outside her family. She allegedly reached inside her own family too, just to twist the knife a little bit more. And here's where it all connects. Forensic accountant Brooke Carrington testified that by the time Eric Richens died in March of 2022, Corey had approximately $7.5 million in debt with monthly payments of $80,000. Her net worth was negative $1.6 million. Carrington's exact words, it was imploding. Her debts and liabilities far outweighed her assets, and if she had sold everything she had, it would have not been enough to get back to zero. And in a separate email to a creditor around the same period, Corey described herself as the head of a company with over 100 employees who had made more than $1 million on her last 5 deals combined. None of it was real. The business was a fiction funded by other people's money, loans, equity lines, life savings, wired by friends, labor from a boyfriend, and marriage she could not afford to leave. Every person in this piece was, according to the evidence, subsidizing Corey's implosion. Corey's bad decisions. Eric with his estate and his forged signature on a life insurance policy. Chelsea Barney with her life savings. An unnamed friend with $45,000. Grossman with his labor, his time, and his emotional investment. Lauber with her freedom. Eric's family with 6 figures and a private investor and years of grief. And when it all finally ran out of other, and when it all finally ran out, other people's resources, all of it. When the business was imploding and the divorce was coming and the exit routes were closing, prosecutors allege Corey made the first move on Valentine's Day. Eric got sick after eating food she allegedly ordered for him. He survived. He called his business partner afraid, and his voice sounded like it only had twice before in his life. 3 weeks later, on March 4th, he did not survive. After Eric died, Corey Richens wrote a children's book about grief. It's called Are You With Me? The cover shows a father with angel wings. She published it and promoted it publicly. And now, years later, 5 children who no longer have a father because of what prosecutors allege she did are old enough to understand what a trial is. Cody Wright, the business partner who got the phone call on Valentine's Day, had to sit in a courtroom and describe the fear in his friend's voice to the jury. Chelsea Barney, who had no life savings left, took the stand and testified against the person she considered her closest friend. Carmen Lauber became an immunity witness. Eric's family spent $100,000 in a private investigator just to be heard. And somewhere out there, a children's book is still for sale. If prosecutors are right, the full accounting of what Corey Richens left behind isn't just a list of victims. It's the portrait of a worldview, one where other people exist to fulfill a function. And when the function is finished, so is the relationship. Everyone got something from her, until the moment they became inconvenient, and then they got something else entirely. Eric Richens was the one who couldn't survive it. Your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube and Substack. I get even more angry because it's just God. This is why she needs to be put away forever, because she will go out there and this is her modality. I don't think she's sitting there like with like an evil cauldron going, how can I screw people over today? It's just what she does. This is how she thinks you're supposed to act. And no one's going to tell her different. However she got there, whatever made Corey Richens, her screwed up childhood, being abandoned, being, you know, the people that, I mean, you get it. It makes sense. Her childhood was shit. But at the end of the day, we all grow up. And we have to take accountability for our choices. And we can't just keep repeating the pattern of the monsters before us and go, don't blame me, blame them. No, blame you. You made the choices. You face the consequences. Your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube and Substack. We'll continue the conversation there. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of our coverage of this case and the many that we cover for you right here. Wherever you get podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeart, hit subscribe. We do greatly appreciate it. We'll continue the conversation in the comments. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Beyond the legal chess match, there's something else happening in the courtroom of Corey Richens. 40 witnesses, text messages, jail calls, a boyfriend who broke down, crying on the stand. A life story Corey wrote about herself in the third person at a wellness retreat. That's another piece of evidence that's going to be introduced and discussed very soon as the defense takes the stand. The question isn't just what the evidence says, it's what the jury is actually absorbing. Bob Mata is with myself and Robin Drake as we continue to break down the case against Corey Richens. Let's talk about Corey and this letter that she wrote. She wrote basically her life story at a wellness retreat back in 2021 in third person. She described a marriage that emotionally exhausted her, a mother with a gambling addiction, a childhood that never really stabilized. I mean, it's heavy stuff. When I heard about this, when I started to look at it, my reaction was, well, there's the recipe. That's how you got Corey. That's how Corey is the way she is. A lot of instability, a lot of chaos. You bring somebody up in that environment. This is your odds of getting somebody like Corey, if she did it, are pretty high. I mean, at least to have, if she has, again, we can't diagnose her, but if we look at this from personality disorders and things of that nature, all of that is a recipe for exactly this, for the type of behavior that the prosecution is alleging that Corey was undertaking and behaving in. And then defense asked the whole document for it to come in, not just the redacted version. Let's talk about that, Bob. What does a jury actually do with that? Is this going to make her look more human, or does it frame everything that came after it?
I mean, it depends, right? Yeah. It depends on what the jury's already feeling about her, you know, mm-hmm. what they've already decided about her, you know, because it's like that thing with every trial is the defense is always standing up during openings and asking the jury to please wait. The state has the opportunity. They have the ability, and they are the ones that always put their case on first. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when people make up their minds, you know, and defense attorneys understand that, mm-hmm. you know, they're putting on their entire theory, you know? So it's like, you're asking these jurors, all right, they're going to put on their case, you know? And the way I look at it is if a state puts on their case and they don't get to, you know, the end of their case in chief and it doesn't look like the defendant's guilty, well, then you fucked it, right? Yeah. I mean, like the defendant better look guilty at the end of the state's case in chief. Otherwise, they got a real problem with their case. So, you know, you tell them, look, you got to wait. We're going to give you context. We're going to fill in the gaps. Like they're telling you what they think happened, and that's all it is. It's what they think happened. They weren't there. So depending on how they're feeling about Corey, it plays a lot of different ways. I mean, yeah. If they're feeling sympathetic, you know, like you said, T, it's like troubled childhood, you know, emotional,
yeah,
absent, like an emotionally absent marriage that she clearly wasn't happy in. You know, she's a woman under pressure. You know, her entire childhood was probably not too dissimilar from a lot of people.
No,
you know, I mean, it was like, unfortunately, we have a lot of families that are just a mess. Mm-hmm. In this world. And like you said, humans are going to human and life is hard. And, you know, like everybody doesn't have a clean, easy path, you know, and all those things that happen during the course of your life mold you into the person that you're ultimately going to become. Does that mean that it turns you into a murderer? Not necessarily. Does it mean that it can? Yes, I'm sure it can.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, I like to look at it and go, okay, well, it explains it. It's the recipe. It's part of what made this person to be the way they are. And we can look historically at other cases and go, oh yeah, this person who exhibits a lot of these same sort of characteristics, traits, and actions also had a very similar upbringing. I mean, it's certainly, I have empathy for it and I feel bad for anybody who has to go through it. It doesn't excuse the behavior though, at the end of the day. And obviously, no one's asking it to, but it to be introduced, I think it's fair. It makes sense. Everybody should have context as to what this person is, who this person is. It doesn't like, oh, you had a really horrible childhood and you were abandoned left and right by the people that you should have, that you should have been able to trust, but they weren't there for you, which explains why you acted the way you did in so many ways. And I'm not even saying murder. I'm just saying what we know about her actions in other ways. Again, doesn't excuse it, but it explains it, which is important for context. What is the back and forth here in this trial? Because there's been a lot of back and forth with some interesting statements coming from both Eric and from Corey. We've heard now that Eric had said to some friends, I believe family members, that, you know, if something happens to me, and I'm just paraphrasing, you know, look at her. I don't trust her. He was moving money around. He was moving beneficiaries with life insurance policies around because he didn't trust her. If something happens to me, look at her. She probably did it. And then we find out at the same point when he's saying this, well, guess who also starts saying this to people? Corey starts telling other people that if something happens to me, Eric did it. I mean, one has a backed kind of track record history of this looks kind of shady, like there would be a reason to say it. The other, not so much. I don't know. What's your take on this with both of them saying, if something happens to me, it's the other partner that did it?
I mean, to me, the takeaway is that this was a broken marriage.
Yeah.
You know, and broken in two different ways. I thought, kind of to dovetail back into that retreat journal letter thing she wrote.
Yeah.
You know, you had the friend who I thought was a powerful witness for Corey, mm-hmm. wherein she was talking about, you know, she really kind of brought to light the fact that Eric was very financially controlling. You know, and that Corey's in this marriage with three kids, and she feels extremely nervous about moving forward with the divorce because of the fact that Eric controls all the money, and she's looking ahead at what is that going to look like. Eric's going to live in the nice house. He's going to have the four wheelers and all the toys. Eric's going to essentially be living in Disneyland, and I'm going to be living in a fucking hovel. You know, and like my kids aren't going to want to be with me. You know, which is a real thing.
Like, maybe if you weren't cheating and being a shitty human being, that wouldn't be the outcome.
I don't know. I mean, Eric, it's come out that Eric was not faithful either, at least emotionally. You know, it's like, again, like we're listening to that. We're listening to the state's case in chief, dude.
True.
Like,
we are.
Like,
we are.
You know, let's wait and hear all of it.
You're right.
And you know, it's like, you get that Jay thing going on sometimes, T. You know, I'm like, all right, take a breath, man. It's like, I hear you. Yeah, like, she definitely could have done this. There's no question. I'm not saying in any, by any stretch of the imagination, she didn't kill her. I'm just saying I'm waiting. I want to hear it all come out. I want to hear all the context because I understand more than most that obviously this is a theory. The fucking state wasn't there. They don't know what happened. They did a shit investigation. They couldn't even... Like they didn't collect the evidence. It's like we have these huge gaping holes in the state's case because the cops didn't do a good job on the front end. And we had a cop get on the stand yesterday. And I'm talking about, what's her face? can't remember her name. She was the one cop who was on the stand. It was like, O'Driscoll's coming today, but she.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
Who Amy Richens, who is one of Eric's sisters, you got Amy and you got Katie, had allegedly told her going into the house that she thought that Corey had something to do with this. Mm-hmm. So she goes into the house with the mindset, all right, I'm going to give that the weight that I think that it deserves as a cop, but she's planted the seed, mm-hmm. at least that this, there might be foul play going on here. So if you're that cop going into that house, I think that, and they got a consent search, and, you know, I think that they limited it to the garbage can, you know, but when you have Corey saying that I made drinks and, you know, then we celebrated a bit and then I went into my kid's room. He was having a nightmare. That's where I fell asleep. I came back 3 a.m. to go back to my bedroom and Eric was cold and blah, blah, all that shit. You have to be thinking, okay, well, I need to be looking for the cups that she made the drinks in. And mm-hmm. it never happened. Like, mm-hmm. I know nothing about whether it had been in the dishwasher, whether they had already been washed, whatever the case may be. I mean, if the cups are there and they're already washed, to me, that's evidence.
Yeah.
Because if I find out that Corey typically left dishes in the sink and she wasn't one to immediately wash dishes, well, then that's kind of powerful evidence. Even if you're not able to pull the fact that there's fentanyl laced somewhere in that cup when they send it to the lab, it's still powerful evidence. So I mean, man, like, yeah. I don't know. I know what your question was, T, and I know I got a little far afield, but it's hard to answer because there's so many gaping holes, and I just don't know either of these people in real life. And you know, yes, we're seeing, you know, text messages and certain things from certain snippets of their life, but it's not the whole picture.
Sure.
You know, so I don't know, man. I don't know.
And, you know, Bob, when, I mean, they've had a lot of people hit the stand on this, and I'm curious, you know, as a defense attorney, do you typically go into the day, you know, knowing who's going to be on the stand and pretty much scripting out or at least have a really good idea of how you're going to do cross? And at any point, are you kind of thrown and do a lot of improv? And is the improv based on your emotional reaction, other things, the stimulus coming at you from the courtroom, the jury? You know, just kind of walk me through. I'm just always curious about how your mind's working in those moments, because it's just more layering of burden on top of what your brain is being exhausted by.
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's, I love those, like, how the sausage are made questions.
I love really, them too. I'm sorry.
it gives people context. Like, if you were to go into a court TV chat room, everybody's got pitchforks and torches, like, fucking burn her, kill her. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, it's like, oh, these two women are idiots. I'm like, you know, I like these questions because it kind of flushes out. So you got three defense attorneys on this team, all right? And they got the witness list. And you can tell Ramos is the guy that was handling kind of the science type stuff. And then between Lewis and Nestor, they split up the other witnesses. And they're looking at our, like, so they know going in, you know, no one is being surprised. We don't do trials by ambush in this country.
Right.
You know who's going to be called. So, yeah, you're looking through in terms of what the police reports are saying, if they've had the opportunity to have their investigator speak to a witness and they've gotten more information, that's always helpful. Doesn't often happen, but yeah, you're like, I typically, and Allie, my wife, we would typically bullet point and make somewhat of a script for a cross, knowing who we were going to be handling, you know, and one of the other parts is that the state is playing somewhat nice here in the sense that they're giving the defense the heads up on who they're going to be calling the next day, which is, again, is a big deal because you can, like, they have no obligation to do it. You know, I've been in plenty of trials where the state was, you know, basically like, pound sand, dude, I'm not telling you shit. Good luck. You know, you're guessing on who we're going to be calling, which, as you can imagine, when you're trying to prep going into that trial day and you know there's going to be anywhere between 4 and 8 witnesses, depending on length, called during that day. And you don't know if you're getting called in terms of my witnesses getting called, I got to be prepped. So you're trying to prep your cross questions ahead of time. And then when you get into it, right, when you're in the direct and you're listening and you're trying to take notes and see what the state is asking, you know, and has there been anything that they said that was inconsistent? You know, you're on high alert because those are the things that you have to catch in the heat of a trial with a million things going on and your mind just racing. So, yeah, I mean, there is a fluidity to it. I mean, you want to have your bullet points. You want to have the things that you want to attack going into the direct. But if you're surprised, and there's been surprises for the defense here, you know, there's been things that have popped up where people have changed their stories. You saw Nestor struggling with it. You know, like last, I think it was week one, where the witness had, and we're talking about Carmen Lauber, changed her fucking story. There now became a fourth deal, which the defense didn't know about until the first time at trial. And so you've got her trying it. And when people were just ragging Nestor, she doesn't know what she's doing. She's okay. I'm like, no, man. Like, this woman is having to refresh the recollection of a witness who doesn't fucking remember anything on top of trying to impeach her, which is a different thing. Right. So you got her because she was trying to go back to all of her seven interviews, 926 pages or whatever it was of transcripts of all the seven interviews she did with law enforcement to go through to show that at no point in time did she ever tell any of the law enforcement agents that she was talking to that she had ever done a fourth deal. So, but she couldn't remember any of it. So then she had to go through the process of refreshing her recollection and then trying to impeach her. But Lauber would forget what she was just recollected on. So it was like watching it was super painful in a lot of ways, but it wasn't necessarily Nestor's fault in the sense that she was surprised by it. And you have a witness who has basically no memory, you know? So like, that's a really, really tough witness to deal with. So, yeah, I mean, you try to be as prepared as you can. You're always going to be surprised by something when you're doing cross. And, you know, I mean, the golden rule is you just don't ask a question that you don't know the answer to because, you know, that can end in disaster for you.
Yeah.
How do you think it all played out at the end of the day, Bob, with the drug dealers, with the housekeeper and Crozer and the whole chain of everybody explaining, none of us really knew it was fentanyl. We all claim it was something else from the Michael Jackson drug to OxyContin or codeine or depending on the day of the week, what he was buying. How do you think that played to the jury? Because they were fairly unreliable witnesses. They weren't the most credible folks. But at the end of the day, the overall message that everyone pretty much could agree upon was that somebody got Corey really powerful drugs. We don't know. We can't necessarily name exactly what that drug was other than when we do the testing of what killed Eric. But there was a drug exchange between all of these people. When it comes to the defense of Corey Richens, the only way to really tear that down is to say that Corey had no knowledge of any of this and that she never got any drugs from her housekeeper. But there's a lot of evidence pointing to the contrary, like text messages. So, yeah. I mean, I don't know how you're going to, how are they going to counter this when it's the defense's turn? I know they obviously had cross, but can they go any deeper? Is there any other place to go on this, or is it just let it lie where it's landed?
Nah, I think they're gonna have to dig into it because at the end of the day, it's like, what are these 12 people in the box? Actually, it's eight. I was shocked to find out.
Yeah,
so it's eight and four alternatives or alternates. So it's an eight-person jury, which is always unusual. I mean, in Illinois, it's always 12, you know, unless you do it like a Pettit jury. But so, I mean, it depends on who they found more credible. You know, it's like that thing where people were feeling a certain way about Nestor going at Lauber the way that she did, which I thought she was not being real bitchy or shitty to her. I thought she was struggling trying to get her to remember and recollect things, you know, but people that walked away, the public seemed to feel like that she was like shaming her, you know, like the whole thing with, you know, the fact that her daughter had OD'd, like people were taking exception to the fact as to why she would have brought that up when it was evident why she brought it up. That it was evident because she needed to show, she being Nestor, that, Lauber wouldn't fuck with fentanyl because her daughter OD'd on it.
Yeah.
Like, it was a very important point. Like, I don't mess with fentanyl or fentanyl. I don't take fentanyl. I don't deal fentanyl. It ain't my thing.
Like, unless you don't know that that's what's in your stuff.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So like that was important, but people didn't look at it that way. Like, like lay people were like, oh my God, like why? And then, you know, the whole thing with the disability, mm-hmm. you know, which was a fair question because she's trying to show that, again, she being Nestor, that Lauber was very susceptible for various reasons. One being the whatever her disability was, which she wanted to know what it was, the learning disability. And she also needed to know about her drug use. And by her own admission, Lauber's like, I've been using since I was six. My brain is basically a cooked egg. Mm-hmm. At this point, you know, and when you're talking about somebody being susceptible to law enforcement, being able to coerce that person, you have to lay that shit out because that's exactly what the defense is saying. The defense is saying they planted the seeds with you. Mm-hmm. Like you didn't write out this statement. She wasn't trying to say, oh, you can't even write. She was saying the cops wrote the statement. Those aren't your words written on there. That's the cops interpreting what you said to them and them writing the statement. Mm-hmm. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So it's like, but it doesn't matter how I look at it. It matters how 12 people or sure. people on the jury looked at it. So, man, like, and I thought Crozier, in my estimation, was the more credible of the two witnesses. I just did. You know what I'm saying? Like I thought, and ultimately at the end of the day, I walked away from that not feeling like the state proved that Corey Richens knowingly purchased fentanyl. You know, and it's like we had that long discussion last week about does the Michael Jackson drug, does that cover him? If she mentioned the Michael Jackson drug, is that enough to meet specific intent? And I don't think that it is. I mean, I would certainly be arguing that in closings. That ain't it.
Yeah.
Specific intent means that she knew she was getting something that if I dosed enough of that particular substance, it was going to kill my husband. My intent was to buy it for the specific intent to kill him. And from neither of those people did I get that because you have Crozier who that statement, and I think we covered it last week when you played the clip, or I can't remember. I might've been on a different show mm-hmm. where Crozier's not the one who said there was fentanyl in here. The cop said it. Mm-hmm. And then Crozier agreed, but Crozier was very clear. He's like, I was not dealing in fent at that point. I was dealing because at that point, the bad fent had already made it in. So, and it was killing people left and right. If you're a drug dealer, dealing drugs that kill your customers is bad business model. So, you know, that it's not going to be something they're going to continue to do. They're going to step back from it and say, okay, I'm not going to fuck with the fentanyl shit. So at that point, he's dealing in hydrocodone exclusively. So that's where you had the M30s. So to me, it's the biggest hole in the state's case because everything else points to a pretty strong motive. Right.
Yeah. I
mean, if the jury is going to lean on the motive alone and they're going to say, well, you know, I don't necessarily think that the state, I mean, if I'm the defense, I'm saying you can't do it. I know that you want to because they put on all this evidence that makes it seem as if it happened. The problem is that they couldn't prove the most important elements of the murder charge. So you can't find her guilty on that.
Yeah. I mean, it's going back to the people. They have to, you're dealing with humans and how they're going to interpret the information. Yep. Your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube or Substack on this segment. We'd love to get your feedback.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.